Good evening. That was a composition written by Eric Satie, Jim Napoli, and I'm your host, John Christensen, for the Perceiving a New program. This evening we're going to be talking with Dennis Lewis, author and Qigong teacher and Taoist teacher. Dennis has written two books, The Tao of Natural Breathing and Free Your Breath, Free Your Life, How Conscious Breathing Can Relieve Stress, Increase Vitality, and Help You Live More Fully. Dennis, do we have you on the air?
Yes, you do, John.
Wonderful. Dennis, you have been teaching since 92, I believe, with Qigong and breathing and meditation, and it seems like there's been a very strong emphasis on breathing. I was wondering if you could talk with our listeners about what drew you in to become such a serious student of the breath.
Well, it really starts back, I guess, in a way, with my birth. I was a breech baby. Mm. I came into the world upside down with a umbilical cord tied around my neck, and apparently the doctors thought I would be dead when I was born.
Could you speak a little louder, Dennis?
Yes. Okay. Do you want me to repeat that, or
maybe just the last part? That
okay. Well, it was just the fact that I was born upside down with the umbilical cord wrapped around my neck, and the doctors assumed that I would be strangled when I. but I didn't remember that, and even really know that for many years. I mean, my mother told me that much later in mm-hmm. my life, and but I had a kind of fascination with the breath early on, experimenting with holding my breath and things like that. And then I started working more consciously with the breath when I was starting perhaps in my late 20s, as I took part in a spiritual tradition called the Gurdjieff work. And part of what we did was to observe ourselves as we are. And of course, when you observe yourself as you are, a big part of what you observe is your breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the breathing became very clear to me that the breath was a kind of miracle, and both a miracle and a mystery, if you like, and that it was something that we took for granted, and yet many of us hold our breath and we breathe faster than we need to at times. And so I started getting very interested in that over time, and it took quite a bit of time. I studied then for a while for several years with Jean Klein,
yes,
a non-dual teacher in the Advaita tradition, and again we worked with the breath. We worked specifically with pranayama, and so I was brought back to the breath again.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the Taoist tradition, I was also brought to a study of the breath, because that's a big part of what the Taoists work with, either directly or indirectly. So there were several different streams, but the main point was that I began to see that many people were teaching breathing techniques that weren't really getting to the root of the issue with the breath, and were perhaps creating, were perhaps even creating problems. And I saw that as I tried to do pranayama work, and I saw other people doing pranayama work, which was originally designed for people from India, and was part of a whole tradition of various yogas and so on. So I started doing more research on this. I wanted to understand better, well, how does the breath really relate to all the different sides of ourselves, body, mind, and spirit?
Yes.
So that was kind of the beginning of the research for the book, The Tao of Natural Breathing.
I see. So it's just been very fundamental, and you've been brought back to many different things. One of the things you mention in Free Your Breath, Free Your Life, that one of the things that you tend to emphasize in your teaching is that you don't see in a lot of other teachings is an emphasis on awareness of actually, aside from breathing exercises and breathing physiology or what have you, it seems like you're very committed to bringing this quality of actually being aware of what you're doing when you're doing it.
Yes, absolutely. The awareness is fundamental in my work, and for that we need to sort of go back a little bit. I had mentioned earlier that I had the first teaching, I'd say, for many, many years was the Gurdjieff work.
Yes.
I don't know if you're familiar with Gurdjieff.
Yes, a little bit.
Uh-huh. Well, in any case, as I was involved in that, part of the reason I was involved in that was because I saw fairly early on that we lived a rather unconscious life, most of us, all of us, in fact, that all the people that I knew at that time, and that we weren't living in correspondence with our birthright, with what was really possible for us, with the both the beauty and the awareness and so on. And so I felt very strongly that the awareness, I mean, very early on, the awareness became an integral part of kind of everything that I did, and the idea of waking up from our sleep, beginning to feel the question, who am I? Beginning to feel that question in a real way, instead of just making the assumption that I am what I do, or I am what I think, or I am what I feel, or I am what I sense, and so on.
Dennis, if I could interrupt just for a moment.
Sure.
We're getting a little bit of popping towards the top, and just talked to an engineer, and we've taken all we can. I think you might be a little too close to your phone. I know I asked you to speak up at the beginning, so I'm kind of giving you this push-pull, but we are...
Okay, that's fine. I'll just... how is this now?
That's better, yes, yes.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. I was trying to speak a little closer to the phone and a little louder. So.
Yes, this is. I think this works. My engineer is giving me a thumbs up that we've got
great.
Enough volume and we're not
great.
Popping. Okay,
great.
Thanks. Because I want to make sure that you know we're getting the highest quality we can across the air here.
Right.
So
the other
you.
Thing is that I had my own company for many years, and it was a public relations agency, and we grew from 3 people to 45 people rather rapidly and then sold the company. But I went through an enormous amount of stress.
And
I began to see that stress was one of the real killers, unnecessary, not stress per se, but unnecessary stress and the way that we sometimes respond to the natural stresses of life. And so part of the work that I undertook for several years then was in relation to Jean Klein and the non-dual work,
mm-hmm.
and once again I was led back to the fundamental issue of the question, who am I?
Mm-hmm.
And that really is a question that demands awareness. In other words, it's not a mental awareness or an emotional awareness. It demands a different dimension of awareness. And I began to see that it was possible to, if you like, practice this awareness with the breath.
Mm-hmm. So I seem to have lost Dennis.
No, I'm here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I'm here. I just thought maybe I just wanted to leave some space for you to come in if you wished.
Great.
Well, let me give you an example of what I mean by that,
okay.
And I think it's a really important one. Every now and then, we feel the question, who am I? It awakens in us, right?
Yes, yes.
And sometimes it comes in moments of a great shock. It can come when you're sick. When you're suffering in some way, we've seen that with many of the teachers, Eckhart Tolle and Byron Katie and people like that who are on the scene. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that that question, who am I, really comes in very strongly at such moments. It can also come in moments of true wonder and joy. So, for example, when you're really feeling the mystery of your life, or you're feeling a great sense of joyfulness,
yes.
The question, who am I, can arise again. It can also arise as a result of any conscious efforts we make in our lives to live more honestly. And that's something that many people today are trying to do. I think we see it all around us, people trying to live more honestly. And sometimes it just seems to arise by itself as a gift from the unknown.
Yes.
Now, when that question arises, what do we do? Well, one thing is we experience it, right? We experience, who am I? We allow that question to be felt in the whole body and the mind and the feelings, in every perceptive faculty that we have. But one way that you can begin to work with it, you can support its flowering, is to check in on your breathing when you have that sense of who am I. And allow your awareness to move inward with your breath. On every inhalation, the breath draws us inside to the unknown in a way. We don't know where the breath comes from. We don't know where it goes.
Mm-hmm.
But as we breathe, we can be called to move inward with the breath and begin to experience ourselves as a breathing being.
Yes.
You know, in the Bible it says, God created man of the dust of the earth and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul.
Mm.
So in all the traditions you find this, you find the idea that the breath comes from something higher in us.
Mm-hmm.
It comes from God, it comes from the Absolute, it comes from consciousness. It doesn't matter what term we use, but it comes from someplace higher in ourselves. And of course, many people are trying to manipulate the breath with their mind, right?
Yes,
yes. Various breathing techniques and
definitely.
So on. And there's a basic contradiction there, because the breath is something that's rather unknown in us. I mean, we think we understand it. We can hold our breath. We can speed up our breathing and so on.
Yes.
But in actual fact, we don't quite understand how the breath ties together all these different sides of ourselves, the physical, the emotional, the mental, and the spiritual.
Yes, I have to agree. And when I was reading your book, Free Your Breath, Free Your Life, and for anyone just tuning in, this is KMUD. I'm John Christensen, hosting the Perceiving a New program, and I'm talking with Dennis Lewis, author of Free Your Breath, Free Your Life. And Dennis and his work can be accessed at www.breath.org.
www.breath.org? No.
That's not the best website.
That's not the website. It's www.dennislewis.org.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Right. I remember that's when you gave
me. DennisLewis.org or authentic-breathing.com.
Okay.
Yeah. Breath.org is actually an early website that I don't use anymore, even though there's some pages up.
Okay. Excuse me.
no problem.
I transposed that. But I thumb through your book looking for what you might have to say regarding the breath and anger. And you had some things to say about anger and some other emotions. I wonder if you could talk with our listeners a little bit about the emotions and the breath.
Okay. I'm going to take a long way around about this to explain this, because it's a really important question. And it's not such a simple one, but with what I just mentioned a minute ago about sort of allowing this question of who am I to expand inward with the breath, that we can actually begin to practice exploring who we are by following the breath inward into ourselves, right? I had just talked
yes.
a little bit about that.
Yes.
And what that involves, and we're going to get to anger in a minute and some of those emotions and anxiety and so on, but what that involves is beginning to discover that inside this body that we take for granted, this body-mind that we take for granted, there's a tremendous amount of space. or let me put it another way. The body is, at a certain level, space.
Yes.
And in order to experience the spaciousness of the body, in order to begin to experience the body as a doorway into spaciousness or into the unknown or into consciousness itself, into who we really are, it's a kind of doorway. In order to experience that, we need to begin to start with just, or it can be helped if we start with some very simple things like as the inhalation takes place, feeling how the belly expands or wants to expand. And when the belly expands or wants to expand, there's a kind of sense of space in the abdomen, albeit a very simple, almost primitive space, but nonetheless a bit more spaciousness than we usually have when we're caught up in our emotions in our daily life, right?
Yes.
When we're emotional, the gut, the belly, the abdomen becomes very tight and very constricted, as does the breath. And what happens is we start breathing faster, or we start breathing very in a very staccato way, in a very disharmonious way.
Yes.
So
yes.
The first step then, if you're going to work with your breath, is beginning to feel the inherent spaciousness of the breath.
Mm-hmm.
And on the inhalation, you can actually begin to feel the belly opening and the chest perhaps opening and the back opening and even the pelvis opening quite naturally. So when I use a term like check in on your breathing, it's to begin to feel, well, where are the movements of my breath taking place? Now, as you work in that way, one of the first things that you understand, at least that I came to, was that in order to work in that way, I had to find a different place in myself from which to observe. I had to find, an inner stillness. And that stillness, by the way, is always there in us. It's always there. It's who we are at the most fundamental level, this kind of welcoming stillness, consciousness. Some people call it love, a kind of allowing things to come into us, into the stillness, into the silence. That's there. And the breath can be a reminder of that, because as we inhale, as the in-breath takes place and the out-breath takes place, we can begin to follow where is it going and where is it, where is it coming from, where is it going, how does it leave us? And we're brought to a kind of practice of meditation, if you like, in action, or stillness in action. Because in order to truly observe the breath, you have to find a very still part of yourself. Now, when you start finding that still part of yourself, that inner silence, if you like, it's at some level who we really are, then when anger comes up, when anxiety comes up, these things can still come up, one can be reminded to come back to that place where the question, who am I, resounds. And when that question resounds, we're brought back to this spacious quality. And the breath can help us in that. So in a moment of anger, in a moment of anxiety, we can actually begin to watch our breath. And as we watch our breath, we realize the only way we can really watch our breath, sense our breath, feel our breath, is to go inside the body, inside the mind, and begin to feel what's actually happening there. And as we feel these movements of the in-breath and the out-breath taking place, as we allow the whatever the truth of that moment is, let's say the breath becomes very rigid and constricted.
Yes.
Right? And one is very angry.
Yes.
Or one is very sad, very emotional in some way, very anxious. Whatever the breath is manifesting at that moment, if I allow myself to honestly perceive it, to say, ah, my breath is constricted now, this is what's happening, I'm angry, or anger is taking place. And if I stay with that and begin to go deeper inside the body and begin to feel again how the belly opens on the in-breath and closes on the out-breath, how space begins to appear in the body, then that space resonates in a way with the spaciousness of who I really am. In other words, the body begins to manifest the true spaciousness of who I am, and the breath can help us in that. Do you see the connection there?
Yes, and I've been watching it fairly recently, more and more with the anger, and we have an expression. Are you still with me, Dennis?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Oh, you said you had an expression.
We just went so silent. I wasn't sure if we were still here. There was some sort of a hum that went away. So good. Well, there's an expression. He literally spit out the words. When someone is really telling someone when they're very angry, and there's that forcefulness in the exhale that. Is very telling, very telling. And then I also noticed This evening, when I was getting ready to go, I misplaced my car keys. There's all the winter weather. There's so many pockets to put them in, and I started getting nervous that I, you know, was going to have to climb under my car and get my, you know, hidden key out in the rain from my car. And I noticed that my breathing had gotten very constricted. My whole chest felt like I just was wearing an iron lung, and I could feel my breathing starting to get faster and higher.
Right.
And somehow just being able to sense that and find my car keys, I was able to move out of that anxiety, which was just interesting to watch it come up.
That's a really important observation, because it's those kinds of observations that begin to awaken a real interest in us to go deeper into what's really happening as I breathe and as I move through the world breathing. What does it mean to be a breathing being? What does it mean? What is breath really about? And of course, the words we're speaking right now are riding on the waves of our breath, right?
Yes.
So breath is very much involved in what we communicate and how we communicate, both to ourselves and to others. If our breathing is constricted, then what we communicate will be very constricted. The words that come out will not manifest the spaciousness of who we really are, will not manifest the truth of who we really are. It will manifest how we are at that moment, that's for sure. Angry, anxious, whatever it is, that will be manifested. But then we forget about that, and that becomes part of our, if you like, our egoic prison. In other words, there are certain kinds of anger and anxiety and sadness and grief and, well, there are moments when anger is called for, of course, and there are moments when grief is called for, when you lose a loved one and so on. But we're constantly creating, in a certain sense, in our lives, moments of anger and anxiety round about stories that we tell ourselves that come from the ego,
that
come from our self-image, that come from our conditioning, from all the stuff that we've, you know, thought we've learned about ourselves and believe about ourselves, and all the stories we tell ourselves, you know.
Yes.
And it's quite remarkable. It's quite remarkable when you realize how much of this is just imaginary. It's just totally imaginary.
I was always struck by the story that Philip Coppola talked about in Seven Pillars of Zen, where he insisted that the more upset you are, the stronger your sense of self is, the stronger you're running this sense that you can't do that to me, they can't say that about me, I'm not going to put up with that.
Right.
And that the stronger the sense of that self is, there seems to be a direct correlation with how angry we can get.
I use the word sometimes identification. It's a word that Gurdjieff used.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we also have the word attachment, which conveys the same thing. But you can bet that the more angry you get, the more anxious you get, and all of those things, the more identified you are with some very tiny part of yourself,
mm-hmm.
or some idea, or some story,
mm-hmm.
or some image. And it's usually what you just said. It's roundabout, you know, often about what other people think of me. They're not giving me my due. They're not paying enough attention to me. They're not giving me what I should have, and they're not treating me right, and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you.
Well, you know, when you were talking a little bit earlier about Sean Klein, I had a conversation with a friend one time in a parking lot in Ojai, and he said that, who are you? Have you ever really tried to really stay with that? And he said that Sean Klein had suggested that if you really, really, really track it down, that you'll get to a tension, some kind of small little tension in the body. And I don't quite have the words on it or whatever, but it seems like there's some kind of correlation that the quieter that tension is, the less that self is dominating the consciousness, and the stronger that sense of self is, the more tense and you know, volatile we are, it seems. I don't know how to translate it into any kind of a discipline or what have you. But
right, right. Well, I think that's true. And let me expand on it a little bit if I can.
Yes.
Every thought, every emotion, every sensation is tied in with the whole organism in a way, and does create, you know, many of our thoughts, many of our emotions. And of course, if you look at your, if you begin to observe your thinking throughout the day and your repertoire of feelings throughout the day, you'll see that you have a fairly narrow range of thoughts that keep repeating and emotions that keep coming up, right?
Yes.
And those thoughts and emotions create tensions in the body, and that tension, that quality of tension, whatever it is, along with those thoughts and emotions, are who we take to be ourselves. And indeed, many of us, you know, at the beginning of any kind of real spiritual work, are very it's scary, really, to begin to realize that we don't know who we are, and that this structure that we begin to bump up against when we start looking at ourselves honestly, this structure of tensions and emotions and thoughts and so on, that this structure is what we've identified with, but it's not really what or who we are. Now, Jean Klein, one of the things he said is, now he's a non-dual teacher, he's an Advaita, was, I mean, he's no longer on the earth, but extraordinary teacher. And one of the things he said, somebody asked him once, he said, well, why do you, he said, in Advaita, you don't really, you know, Advaita says you're not your mind, you're not your emotions, you're not your body, right?
Yes.
And then he said, yet you, Jean, work with the body. You teach this very esoteric form of yoga, which we all learn, we did on a regular basis with him.
Mm-hmm.
And why do you teach work with the body? Why do you have practices with the body if we're not the body? And Jean said, he laughed and he said, well, we in the West live in a culture that has a very bad relationship. People have very bad relationships with their body. We don't have a good relationship, a healthy relationship with our bodies. We're not intimately aware of our bodies. So in a way, this takes us back to the question you asked me earlier about the awareness. Because we need to get closer to our body to recognize that we're not our body. As long as we stay as long as we sort of look at the body as a thing in which there's a mind, we're going to be very identified and attached to all of the processes of the body. But as we begin to become more aware of the body as, so to speak, inside of our awareness, inside of consciousness, as just another object, albeit an extraordinarily alive and vital one, we begin to learn, I think, as Jean said, to love our bodies, you know, with a capital L. In other words, to really appreciate them and to begin to get so close to them that we recognize that that's not who we are. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So
yes.
This work with tension is very, very important. And, of course, when you work with your breathing and do some of the work, some of the practices that I teach, you are brought very much up against all the tensions that are in your breath and in your body and the thoughts and the emotions that support those tensions. You begin to see them more clearly. Your emotional life becomes more exposed.
Yes. I wonder, there's a few things that I wanted to be sure and cover, and I'd like to ask you about them, but first let me do another ID here.
Okay.
This is the Perceiving a New Program. I'm your host, John Christensen. This is KMUD, KMUD Community Radio, and I'm talking with Dennis Lewis, author of Free Your Breath, Free Your Life, and Dennis and his work can be accessed at www.dennislewis.com.
.org.
Thank you.
Yes.
Almost there. Okay. Kind of moving, since we were talking about the physicality of this work, also, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about something that seems to come up inevitably in discussions about breathing, and that is chest breathing, diaphragmatic breathing, and full yogic breathing. I wonder if you could touch on that a little bit, please.
Now, what perspective would you like me to touch on it from? Because it's a huge, huge field of...
Okay. Well, I think oftentimes you'll hear, well, oh, yeah, really, I breathe shallow. I know I breathe shallow. I really should breathe more deeply. And yet it seems in our culture we have, like our clothing can be very binding, really inhibiting diaphragmatic
right.
breathing. And then we also have this cultural idea that you have talked about in all of your books, I believe, and even in perhaps in your CD that you did with Sounds True, the natural breathing CDs. This idea, you know, we want these tight abs, these washboard abs, and this, you know, a lot of tension and a lot of holding. So maybe if you could just talk a little bit about the difference between chest and diaphragmatic breathing.
Okay, yes. First off, I think it's important to understand that to understand a little bit about how the diaphragm actually works and how the breathing process takes place. So, for example, when we inhale, the diaphragm moves or wants to move downward. Now, if somebody has emphysema or some kind of very heavy breathing problem or is very anxious and worried and is breathing really fast, the diaphragm may not be moving very much, especially with somebody who has emphysema, for example. And as we get older, for many of us, the diaphragm begins to move less and less. Now, when the diaphragm is functioning harmoniously and well in a healthy way, it moves through various dimensions. It not only moves up and down, but it moves sideways and angularly. It's a three-dimensional movement that takes place.
Yes.
And as the inhalation takes place and the diaphragm moves downward, what does it meet? It meets all the internal organs and tissues and fluids.
Yes.
And so if I'm holding my belly really tight as the diaphragm wants to move downward, the diaphragm is going to have a very hard time moving downward. And in fact, it's probably going to get stopped before it's really moved through its full range of motion.
Yes.
So what happens when we get anxious and tense and angry? What happens to our abdomen and our belly?
We get tight.
Gets very tight, right?
Absolutely.
And when that happens, the diaphragm has a very difficult time moving. And then the breaths have to be very forced. And then when we force our breathing in that way, we start using more chest muscles. Of course, the chest needs to be able to expand and retract with each breath, but that's not the primary place the movement of the breath comes from. The movement of the breath comes from the diaphragm. And if the belly is tight, the diaphragm is not going to be able to move downward very far, and thus won't have much power to move back up and empty the lungs. So I'll be breathing in a very shallow way. And many people, end up as being upper chest breathers and breathe much faster than they would be if their belly and their lower back and their middle back were freed up.
Yes.
Now, it's really interesting about this because this is not just a physical, yes, it is a physical process, but at the same time, as the belly and the back and the chest and so on become more able to move freely, there's a sense of spaciousness, a kind of natural sense of spaciousness that I have in my body, right?
Yes.
And that sense of spaciousness is very freeing because it's touching upon who we really are. You know, who we really are is this kind of spacious, unknown consciousness, awareness, love. Again, the words aren't so important, but there's another nature. It's like we're two-natured. We have the nature of our functioning, all of that, and then we have this other nature, from which everything sort of comes
mm-hmm.
and to which it returns. And so chest breathing generally means, or heavy chest breathing generally means that the belly and the lower back and the middle back are not free. And that, by implication, could also mean that one is very tied in or identified with a particular emotional state or mental story or thought or something like that. And, of course, we are. If we look at our day, we see how much of this stuff repeats, our thoughts, our emotions, our movements, the stories we tell ourselves, how we relate to others. There's very seldom this sense of perceiving anew, which is the title of your series, right? But to perceive anew means somehow I need to see all of this. That would really be a new perception. I need to see all of this happening and to recognize that it's not who I really am.
Mm-hmm.
It's only how I'm manifesting at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
See what I'm saying? So yes, the chest breathing and the belly breathing, the back breathing and so on, all tie in with this. And of course, what we want is the diaphragm to be free to move in whatever way it needs to move for the demands of the moment, for our breathing. So for example, if we're running, we're going to be breathing one way. If we're meditating quietly, we're going to be breathing another way. If we're talking with a friend, we're going to be breathing a third way. But if our physical structure and emotional structure is so tight that it doesn't allow this freedom of the breath to spontaneously adjust itself, then we're going to find ourselves with the same old impressions. We're not going to be perceiving anew. We're going to be perceiving the same old things, thinking the same old things, and feeling the same old things.
Yes. Yes. You know,
I don't know if does this tie into what you were asking?
Yeah. You know, I had a... when I was in my early 20s, I got some deep tissue work. It was a combination of Rolfing and polarity and Gestalt. It was called Lomi body work. And my practitioner had studied in Hawaii. And he worked on my foot, and it was extremely painful. And it unleashed this romantic... abortive relationship that had fallen apart, and I had a lot of hard feelings about it and what have you. And I, long and short of it, we moved into some Gestalt after I had this just spasmodic pain in my foot, and I got to say some things in the Gestalt that I hadn't been able to say before, and to feel them and what have you. And the aftermath was I was walking along the ocean. This was in Santa Cruz, and my belly was so soft, it felt like I could have just pushed my fingers into the stomach and gone all the way to the anterior of my spine. It was just, it felt like I had a baby's belly. And it was just absolutely incredible, the sun and the ocean and everything. And that, you know, gave me a taste of how much tension I was holding in my abdominal area, and how freeing it was to let go of that. Do you have any suggestions for people who might be listening who might say, yeah, I've got tension in my abdomen. I can hold there. What can I do about it?
Well, one of the practices that I like to give early on, and it's one of the fundamental practices that I teach, especially right at the beginning, but it's one that you can do for your whole life, is what you do is you rub your hands and you get them really warm. At lying down on your bed, for example, or on a soft carpet on the floor, or on a mat, just someplace comfortable on your back, and you get your hands really nice and warm. You put your feet flat on the bed or flat on the floor with your knees bent, so that releases the abdominal muscles. And then you take these nice warm hands and you put them just partly on the navel and partly below the navel, and you feel the warmth and the chi energy coming from your hands. Because there is energy coming from your hands, and there's certainly warmth coming from your hands if you get them warm. And you just notice the warmth, and you let that warmth begin to permeate your whole abdominal region back to your spine. And you notice as that happens how your breath begins to become fuller. The belly begins to move. See, the breath likes to go where there's comfort and ease, where there's ease of being, where there's relaxation. Breath likes to go where it's comfortable. And many of us don't have comfortable bellies. And we, of course, from my perspective, and the story you just mentioned, by the way, is very much in tune with my own experiences when I underwent Chinay Tsang from a Taoist practitioner, somebody who actually worked on my belly.
Yes.
and began to release a lot of the tensions and so on that were there. And as that happened, many emotions began to appear that had been, so to speak, hidden from me.
Yes.
A lot of which was connected with anger, because I had, you know, suppressed a lot of anger connected with my childhood and so on.
Sure.
And hadn't really gotten to be able to see it very clearly and to be free of it. So anyway, so you get your hands nice and warm and on the belly, and you just feel the warmth. There's nothing to do. You see, this is the miracle of this work. There's nothing to do except be aware. And you're aware of the warmth and the chi coming from your hands. You don't put a book on your belly, because a book is inanimate.
Yes.
It's not going to have that energy, that chi.
Yes.
You don't want to be pushing against the book on your belly. That's not the point. And a lot of people do that. And it's really, I think, degrading to the human spirit in a way to work that way. You've got hands. You just put them on your belly and feel the warmth and the chi energy. Allow it to go into the belly. And notice how your breath is affected by that. And as you do that for about 5 minutes, without forcing anything, without trying to do anything, just feeling, sensing, being aware, the belly begins to open more and close more with each breath. And as that happens, the tissue begins to relax and you begin to calm down. This is actually a very good exercise. You can do it in your office as well. You can do it, a lot of people are on their computers a lot. And you can be sitting and you can just get your hands nice and warm and put them on, where I mentioned, on the navel, with part of the hands just below the navel, on the what's called the lower dantian in Chinese medicine or in Taoism, or the hara,
yes,
the Japanese. And just feel the warmth in the chi and let that begin to relax the breath. And you'll notice that the breath will become fuller by itself. You don't have to do anything.
Yes.
It's very interesting. You mentioned the three-part breathing of yoga, right? I think you mentioned that earlier.
Yes.
And I teach at Esalen. I do a 5-day retreat every year, and I'm doing one in May.
Yes.
And then I also teach, I have for the last couple of years, at the Yoga Room in Berkeley, California. I teach there for 3 hours. And it's very interesting because I teach mainly to yoga people and teachers. And a lot of these yoga teachers and students do pranayama.
Yes.
And I recommend against pranayama, and yet I'm always invited to come back. So it's kind of interesting, you know. And it's what's really phenomenal is that some people have been taught to do the three-part breathing with their heads. In other words, first you try to breathe in your belly, then you try to breathe in your middle, abdomen, and then you try to breathe in the upper chest, right?
Yes.
So you have these three different parts.
Yes.
Well, you can't do it right now because you're on the phone, but if anybody's listening right now, you could try this very simple practice. And I teach this practice to people who've been doing yoga for I don't know how many years, and invariably, each time they say, wow, this is extraordinary. The three-part breathing just is natural. I don't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. What you do is you stand and simply raise your arms up very slowly on the inhalation above your head. I'm just going to take a little drink of water here.
Please. Do the same.
So on the in-breath, you raise your arms up above your head very slowly. And on the out-breath, you very slowly bring the arms down. Now, you do that a few times, and then you start bringing your attention inward to see what's happening to your breath as the arms are lifting slowly and gradually up above you without straining. If you try this, you'll see that the movement of the breath corresponds to the movement of the arms. And basically what you're doing is you're training your brain to realize that it can do this three-part breathing in a very natural, easy way. Of course, you're using your arms to facilitate it. But the fact is that if you do this enough, you try this enough in a very gentle way, then what will happen is, a la Feldenkrais. You're familiar with Feldenkrais?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as Feldenkrais showed, the nervous system learns more efficient ways to do things if you're aware of them as you do them. So as you lift your arms and the breath begins to move first through the belly and then up through the middle chest and the upper chest and the back and so on, you do that a number of times. You say, wow, that really feels good. It feels so spacious. It feels like something's opening in me. And then you can begin to have that sensation without lifting your arms. Yes. And the mind doesn't have to do anything. All it has to know is that I want to be aware of my breathing right now. See what I'm saying? It's
yes.
Like the nervous
yes.
system has learned something, and it's learned something that's quite natural. That's why I call my whole approach natural breathing. There's no force or effort.
Well, I just tried that. I was actually able to free myself from the microphone table. And,
oh, good.
And, yeah, that's great.
Yeah, well, you'd have to try it a few times. Now, if you want to make it a little bit more active,
yes,
and you may not be able to do it now because I'll be talking and
sure.
people won't be able to
sure.
hear because as you, so the first maybe 5 or 10 minutes, you just do it lifting your arms, as I said. Then maybe for 5 minutes you do it, and as the arms come down, you just hum. Mm-hmm. And you can go a hum that goes mm-hmm. until the arms come all the way down to your sides. Now, what this has just done is this has activated your diaphragm even further, because we're not used to, most of us are not used to singing, humming, chanting, and so on. And so for many of us, our diaphragms have not learned how to go through a period of time in a very harmonious way. Most of us, we talk a lot, but that's very staccato.
Mm-hmm.
And the diaphragm is not working very evenly as we talk for most of us, unless we know how to do that, unless we stop in time because we've run out of breath, so to speak.
Dennis, I'd like to come in just for a moment for an ID.
Oh, sure.
This is the Perceiving a New program. I'm your host, John Christensen, and we're talking with Dennis Lewis, author of Free Your Breath, Free Your Life. Dennis can be, his work, and Dennis can be accessed at www.dennislewis.org. Okay, please continue, Dennis.
So as you're making that sound, as you're humming with your mouth,
yes,
you know, just closed and just humming, not open sounds, you feel the vibration in your body. Again, we're coming back to the awareness. And you allow that vibration to be felt wherever it's taking place. And the humming itself is actually pushing more air out of the lungs, but it's doing it in a natural way. So instead of trying to empty your lungs forcefully, either through the mouth or through the nose, what you're doing is you're combining sound with breath, and the sound allows the breath now to experience itself, the nervous system to the breath to experience itself in a way, and also the nervous system to experience the breath, the out-breath especially, in a very even and harmonious way. And then you'll see that next time you lift your arms on the inhalation, you'll feel the spaces will even open more. So it's a very wonderful practice, and it'll take you immediately to the three-part breathing without any mental manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, many people, I've seen people trying to do three-part breathing, and I see how much tension they put into their bellies and into their rib cage and their back and so on to do it. And of course, that is not spacious breathing. That's not open breathing. That's forced, constricted breathing.
Yeah.
When you try to force the breath, you generally speaking constrict it. And the very energy that you're taking in through the breath, you're using the majority of it just to breathe when you use that kind of force.
Yes. Something I wanted to ask you about. I've been working with a biofeedback device called a Respirate, and I noticed that it's you have some kind words to say about it on your website. I wondered if you might talk about that a little bit. One conjunction that really stuck in my jaw, so to speak, or that's not exactly what I'm trying to say, but you mentioned that you went to this, you found that observing a lot of heart patients, that 9 out of 10 of them, as I recall, were upper chest breathers, and this Respirate is promoted for lowering blood pressure and what have you. I'm sort of stringing a bunch of things together, but I wonder if you might address.
Sure, sure. Well, there's been, it's not that yes, I've seen some people who have heart issues and who are upper chest breathers, but there's been a lot of research on it, and I have cited a bunch of that research in various places in my books and my website, authenticbreathing.com, and but most of the articles on breathing and so on I have are on the authenticbreathing.com website. What Respirate does is it slows down your breathing, and it does it in a very natural way. In other words, instead of trying to breathe more slowly, as you know, and again making it a mental phenomenon, what Respirate does is it uses music that gradually, two little simple tunes that gradually slow down, and you inhale and exhale in relation to how the tunes are going up and down that you're listening to. So you put on these headphones and you listen to the music, and you have a strap around your chest that's measuring how often you're breathing. And rest break gradually slows your breathing down, but it does it in a very natural way just through listening. Just through listening. Now, the problem, rest break is wonderful, and I do recommend it on my website for people who can't work directly with their breathing. There are some people who just don't want to, and they want some kind of device to do it with, who can't work, let's say, with the emotional and all these other sides that we've been talking about.
Yes.
So respirate is very good, but the one thing that respirate doesn't really take into account is the pause after the exhalation. Now, let me talk a little bit about that, because it's very, very important. And let's talk a little bit about the exhalation, and if I forget about the pause, please remind me, because I may get taken by what I do have
we
to
have,
say here.
We have about 5 minutes.
Oh, 5 minutes. Okay. So let me just say that the exhalation is absolutely crucial. If you can't exhale in a natural and complete way without force, then you're not going to be inhaling in a natural and complete way either. And exhalation has to do with letting go. It has to do with emptying ourselves. It has to do with allowing things to happen. It has to do with, you know, allowing life in. It has to do with dying to our self-image, if you like. So that's sort of the big picture about exhalation. There's a pause after exhalation, and that pause, there's a kind of space there that is a resting place before the inhalation comes again by itself. It's not holding your breath. There's a kind of natural pause there that all the great breath therapists have spoken of, and you can begin to see it in yourself when your breath becomes very relaxed. There's a place like coming home there at the end of the exhalation. And that coming home is not, that space at the end of the exhalation is not something that the respirator can account for. But it's very, very important. But even without dealing with that directly, respirator can be a big help to some people, which is why I have it on my, you know, my business website.
I just had this question that's just come up as you explain it very quickly. You know, you say we come to the end of the exhalation and then there's this pause. It seems like that's also what we're, when we're at a deathbed with someone and they've just finished a breath and we're wondering, are they going to take another one?
I couldn't hear you wondering.
I said we're wondering, is that it? Are they going to take another breath? Or
right.
Is that pause going to last forever?
Right. Well, the curious thing about that pause is, now you probably meditate, right?
Yes.
Okay. The interesting thing about that pause is, or the wonderful thing about that pause is that it's a way into who you really are. That pause is a pause of silence. It's a pause of coming home to who you are. And many of us overlook that. You know, we're so busy, we're so active, we're breathing so fast, we're always doing something. We don't ever really come home to ourselves. And the breath allows us to come home to ourselves with every breath. We can be reminded to come home to ourselves. And it's not a matter of holding the breath. It's a matter of exhaling fully and waiting for the inhalation to come by itself. And during that wait, there's a pause. And in that pause, there's a direct doorway into the deepest dimensions of ourselves. And you'll see that in many meditations, actually, that's the place at which the teacher will often say, be very attentive to that place, because that's the place where you can sort of enter in. It's always there, that silence. It's not that the breath manufactures it in some way, no. It's just that the breath helps reveal it. It's always there, that level of silence, that level of stillness, that kind of coming home to yourself.
Can you give me a physiology of the difference between that pause and the pause at the end of the inhalation?
The difference in physiology. Well, in one case, you're holding. You see that when you inhale, you're turning on your sympathetic nervous system.
Yes.
That's the doing process.
Yes.
Inhalation is controlled by the sympathetic nervous system physiologically. Exhalation is controlled by the parasympathetic nervous system.
Yes.
That's the relaxation response.
Yes.
All right. So, what we're doing when we're holding the breath at the end of the inhalation, it's a kind of doing, if you like. It's you know, I'm holding it and so on. It's a kind of forcefulness.
Yes.
When that pause takes place at the end of the exhalation, it's quite different. It's a relaxation into oneself.
A surrender.
It's a surrender. Yes, it's a surrender into oneself. It's letting go. whereas the other one is holding on, holding on to the breath. In the case of at the end of the exhalation, we're letting go of the breath, and we're just waiting to see what life will bring us. What is the next moment going to bring us? Because the inhalation will come again, until it doesn't, until we leave the planet. But until that moment, the inhalation will come again. There's should be no anxiety about it. It will come when it needs to come.
Thank you. Well, we're very close to the end of our hour. If we could imagine for a moment, I've just cornered you in an elevator in Scottsdale going up to the 17th floor. So you're interested in breathing. What should I remember from meeting you in the elevator here for?
Oh dear, one of those. I feel like I'm on a 30-second TV spot or something.
Just find your pause.
What you can remember is that you're alive and that you're breathing, and you can begin to notice your breathing, be aware of your breathing, and realize you don't have any clue where the breath is coming from or where it's going. And this can be a doorway into a deep relaxation into yourself and into a kind of surrender into reality, if you like, instead of all these stories and all these doings and all these things we're telling ourselves and telling other people about ourselves. It's a kind of coming home. The breath is always there for us. It's a kind of anchor that reminds us to come home again.
Dennis, it's been a true pleasure talking with you.
John, it's been great.
And so this is a Perceiving a New program signing off. I'd like to thank our steadfast engineers, Mahoney at the controls. And I've been talking with Dennis Lewis, most recently author of Free Your Breath, Free Your Life, How Conscious Breathing Can Relieve Stress, Increase Vitality, and Help You Live More Fully. And Dennis and his work can be reached at www.dennislewis.com.